This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. My guest today is David C. Corton, author most famously of When Corporations Rule the World. He's got a new ambitious book out entitled The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. David Corton, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Delighted to be with you, Matt.
In the opening of your book, you talk about your years abroad. Why don't you tell me a little about that? Why did you decide to go abroad? What did you do there?
Well, you know, Matt, I actually grew up very conservative in a small town, and I thought my future was going to be to go back and run the family retail business. But, you know, along the way, I was actually, when I was at Stanford as an undergraduate, a very active young Republican and very concerned about the threat of communist revolutions to the American way of life. And in my senior year, we had to take something outside of our field, and so I saw this course on modern revolution. I thought, well, that'll be an interesting way to find out what this threat is about. And what I learned is that these revolutions were born of the frustrations of poverty. So since I was headed for business school, I decided I would go ahead and go to business school with the idea of taking the secrets of U.S. business success abroad so that we could help other countries to become happy materialist consumers like us and get rid of those revolutionary ideas.
So what happened along that road?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of a slow learner, but it took me roughly 30 years working in Africa, then Central America, finally Asia, setting up business schools and then working on rural development programs of various kinds. But began to realize that far from bringing universal prosperity, that the models of development that we were taking forth were actually, they were creating a few really wealthy people, a very small middle class, but most people were getting pushed further to the margin. We were destroying the environment and the, particularly in Asia, these once rich, deep cultures grounded in family and community were being trashed. And the the more I realized the reality, the more disturbed I got in trying to understand why.
And why were they being trashed?
Well, because the models, the economic models that we were pursuing were really about maximizing short-term returns to money rather than long-term well-being of people and planet. And it's interesting, you know, once you start getting into it, how kind of simple it is, because working in the foreign aid business, that's kind of the routine thing. When you're doing a project, you have to justify it with an economic analysis. And this particular approach will produce a higher economic return. Now, you break that down, what it's really about is the highest return to money. Oh, well, that would mean probably the highest return to people who already have money. And the real epiphany started to come through, and began to realize how many of the official kinds of development projects ended up alienating poor people from their land and the water resources they depended on for their livelihoods in order to take them over for use for shopping malls or subdivisions or golf courses or resorts or.
Now, these were development projects funded by USAID or World Bank or IMF?
All of the above. The worst tended to be the World Bank, Asian Development Bank. The IMF, of course, doesn't fund projects. They do balance of payment support. But,
and were you sensing from the people who were adversely affected great hostility toward the organizations that were imposing these projects upon them?
Well, that became more aware of that over time. I mean, my own work with AID tended to be with smaller projects that were somewhat more beneficial, although it was rare to find any of them had any real long-term consequences. The problem with the World Bank is that it's very big and it is very competent at doing what it does, which is usually wrong. AID was just you might say more bumbling. Yeah, we sort of stumbled along, didn't do too much damage, but didn't do very much good either.
David Corton, why did you ultimately decide to come back to the United States then?
Well, I was actually starting to have some conversations with some of our Asian colleagues, one in particular who occasionally comes to the United States. He teaches at Princeton, Smitu Kothari, who in India. And Smitu said, you know, Dave, we think you're beginning to understand what our problem really is, which, of course, is the United States and its model of development and its foreign policies. And you came over here to be helpful to us, and we appreciate that. But if you really want to be helpful to us, you really need to go home and work on education in your own country. And
how long after he told you that did you ultimately up and leave?
Well, it was probably about a year later, 2 years later. And so we moved to New York City. My wife was working for the Ford Foundation at the time, and so we actually had a choice to move to Indonesia or come back to the States. And we decided it was time to come home, and so we settled on an apartment on Union Square between Wall Street and Madison Avenue.
About what year was this?
That was 1992.
And how did you find the States after being away for so long? I assume you'd come back now and again, but did anything hit you upon returning?
Not particularly. I mean, you know, by that point in time, the communications with the States was great. You know, my earlier overseas experience in the mid-60s when we were in Ethiopia, it really was a kind of a stunning shock to come back to the United States. But, you know, we came from the Philippines, and we had followed regular television broadcasts from the U.S., and I was traveling back to the States several times a year, so it was not a big...
Well, how'd you take the step from there to that big book, When Corporations Rule the World?
Well, of course, when I came home, I was continuing to pursue this question of what's the deeper cause of the problem, and... you know, it is so interesting how where you sit, where you draw your income from, so shapes your view of things. And one of the most stunning insights that I was sitting right in the middle of all the time, but couldn't see until about 3 months after I left stopped drawing my salary from the foreign aid system, was how fundamentally pernicious most foreign aid actually is, just from the very fact that real development is about a country learning to use its own resources more effectively. The foreign aid money is only good to buy things abroad. So no matter, I mean, people talk about tied aid, but it's inherently tied because that's what it's for, is foreign aid, for buying things abroad. And even if the money that goes in is supposedly funding local expenses, that's exchanged at the local bank. But it's still what the country's getting is foreign exchange, and so if it's not expended on the project, it ultimately goes back to its origin, and it may be for buying military hardware or for... Serving a debt, yeah, and of course that's the huge thing, that so much of the foreign aid is debt-funded, particularly from the World Bank, and that then leaves the country as essentially a debt slave, because the loans are calculated to be sufficiently big that they can't really be paid back, and that then gives the World Bank and the IMF the leverage to impose economic policies that ultimately are really about increasing foreign control of the local resources and markets. So the whole process in aggregate is about shifting economic power control away from local people and from what might be a positive, constructive national agenda to the interests of particularly foreign corporations and banks.
Now, When Corporations Rule the World, that book, David Corton, that you wrote, would give us a task of trying to gain control over these corporations, which is a tall enough task in and of itself.
Actually, I go beyond trying to get control over them. I think our long-term goal has to be to, you know, I'm specifically concerned with the publicly traded limited liability corporation as an institutional form.
And you talk about dechartering them.
We ultimately need to get rid of that particular form.
So what I was driving at, though, that in itself is a task.
Yeah.
But this new book, The Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community, seems to multiply the task in magnitude. Because you say it's not enough to curb corporate power or to get rid of corporate charters. Now we must overcome a 5,000-year imperial legacy. Why did you broaden the problem so much?
The book, When Corporations Rule the World, of course, got me deeply into the emerging global movement, resistance against corporate globalization. And that movement was gaining enormous momentum up to the point of the 9/11 terrorist attack. And the Bush administration, of course, immediately cracked down on any dissent, equating it with support for terrorism. It's easy to forget how oppressive that felt at the moment and how that swept across the planet as other governments with authoritarian ambitions picked up on that same theme and excuse and began cracking down. So the movement was in kind of temporary disarray. Now, summer after 9/11, I had a visit from Vandana Shiva from India, a close friend and colleague, and we were talking about this disarray. And Vandana was pointing out that the whole global movement had been built around this analysis of corporate power, global financial power, and so forth. But here was the Bush administration talking explicitly about imposing order on the world and securing U.S. interests through naked military power. And, of course, there were politicians and pundits talking about debating the merits of American empire. Now, it's interesting to me, looking back, I never used the term empire and when corporations rule the world. It was not part of our lexicon, except there's a reference in there to Ronald Reagan's evil empire, but, you know, it was not part of the analytic frame. So Vandana pointed out that as a movement, it's very difficult to respond when we don't have an analysis that encompasses that. Now, that conversation triggered in my mind a recollection of Rhianne Eisler's framework from The Chalice and the Blade, her distinction between the dominator and partnership models for organizing human societies, and her observation that some 5,000 years ago, human societies turned away from the kind of earth community, the more partnership modes of organizing, more gender-balanced and generally more peaceful, to the dominator structures of empire. And I thought, this is the frame. Now, of course, what's significant here is if you're talking just about corporate power, you can trace that back 400 years to the founding of the British East India Company. But now we're talking about 5,000 years, and we begin to see that the modern corporate rule and dominance is really just an extension by other means of these deeper patterns. Now, it's also very instructive that once you recognize the dynamic of empire, of organizing societies and dominator hierarchy with a few people at the top, most people at the bottom, that really creates an inexorable dynamic of competition for these positions. And as you begin to understand it, it becomes clear that that is the kind of explanatory framework for sexism, for racism, for war, for poverty, exclusion, just about all of the, and of course, environmental destruction. And that most all of the issues that we face, the devastating social environmental issues, are all a consequence of this particular mode of organizing human societies. Now, what you also begin to realize is that for a whole variety of reasons, but particularly our human consumption coming up against the limits of the planet, that we're really coming to the end of the tolerance, both of the environment and of society, for the imposition of dominator rule.
Yeah, you juxtaposed David Corton, the Great Turning, which is the title of your latest book, with The Great Unraveling, which is the waterfall we're about to go over.
Yeah, also incidentally, a title of one of Paul Krugman's books. But yeah, the point is that I'm making there is, of course, that if we allow the disaster that's unfolding to play out within the framework and stories of empire, we'll have, you know, we will be playing out a last man standing competition for what remains of the Earth's resources.
But what I wonder is whether it isn't possible to solve one or two of those problems that we face right now without getting at this 5,000-year trend. You have kind of an all-or-nothing scenario. You say either we resolve them all, these progressive issues that we care so much about, peace, environment, racism, sexism, by putting empire behind us, you say, or we accept empire and resolve none of them. Is it really that either-or, or isn't it possible to get out of this Iraq war, for instance, or prevent Bush from going to war against Iran, or to take on global warming if we had better leadership, or give people universal health care similarly, or do we really need to go that deep right away?
Well, in terms of ending the Iraq war, I should hope we could do that very quickly. But I'm talking more generally about the dynamics that lead to war, not just a specific war, but war in general. I think, in fact, I mean, we got to put this in a larger context. I mean, one of the compelling realities that we've got to deal with as a nation and as a species is the fact that business as usual is really over. You know, many of us have known that we were moving toward a major collapse in the future. Well, the future is here. And we're seeing it play out in peak oil, which we're not sure. Maybe it happened last year. Maybe it's going to be another 20 years or so. But whenever the specific peaking of oil production comes is basically irrelevant because the era of cheap oil is over. We've got a whole economy that is based on cheap oil. And as that plays out and oil prices continue to soar, which they must inevitably do, we're going to see a major shift in economic incentives. Now, that's converging with the consequences of climate change, which is leading to increasing climatic disruption, which will inevitably disrupt our food supply chains, of agriculture, and so forth, all of which is also connecting with our extreme and growing U.S. trade deficit, which is being funded by foreign borrowing. Now, we're presenting us with a potential collapse of the U.S. dollar because the gap between what we export, what we import, and what we export is basically a measure of the extent to which as a nation we're living beyond our own means and paying for the difference with consumer credit. Now, the rest of the world's starting to get a little tired of sending us their wealth for what are essentially worthless IOUs that we have no capacity to repay. Now, all of this coming together is going to dramatically shift the economic incentives and bring enormous economic disruption. So this, you know, this creates a fairly immediate imperative for some very, very significant rethinking and reorientation of not only of our economics but our politics.
Yeah, I see the imperative. Certainly, it's just looming right in front of our faces right now, David Corton. But you posit that the conditions for turning things around, for what you call the great turning, are also in place. And can you enumerate that? Enumerate those.
Yeah, yeah. The basic idea comes from the opening words of the Earth Charter, that this is a moment when humanity must choose its future. Now, the interesting thing, when you're in this competitive dynamic between nations and so forth, traditionally the only way that could be worked out was through war. Now, we finally created the United Nations, which for all its defects is the first time we had a human institution in which the representatives of all the world's people could come together in dialogue rather than settling their differences by force of arms. We've also had the experience of looking back on ourselves from space, to see ourselves as one human community on one living planet. And of course, probably the most significant of all is the development of the internet and virtually costless global communication, which allows people directly to connect and to begin to engage in cooperation and problem solving beyond the limitations of their own governments. Now, these events create the possibility that we've never had before to act as a species, to get out of this empire dynamic. And of course, going back to your earlier question, you know, as long as we're maintaining this hierarchy and maintaining this competition, then all these other dynamics play out, including the imperative to keep mining the resources of the Earth beyond the capacity to regenerate, just to maintain the military forces and the police state, the instruments of the police state necessary to quell resistance. Now, this is another piece of the imperative, of course, that we're learning, that, you know, the whole nature of violence against states has fundamentally changed. And this, of course, is one of the tragedies that the Bush administration is still caught in the old concept of warfare and the use of conventional military, as we see so dramatically, against terrorist networks, which are made increasingly possible by global communication and by the ready access to powerful weapons. This is another aspect of the imperative that we really need to come to terms with these things and begin to create a world in which we can actually learn to live together and share the resources.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today is David Corton, author of When Corporations Rule the World, and most recently, The Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community. One question is, how easy is it going to be to make the great turning when those who are in power, those who have learned to climb to the top of the hill labeled empire and benefit from it, the corporations that you wrote about before, the wealthiest Americans who hoard just a tremendous percentage of our wealth and income in this country, how do we get power away from them?
Yeah, well, as you imply, it's not going to be easy, and there will be enormous resistance. I think the basic strategy has to come ultimately from a popular awakening, and I think it was awakening of a new cultural and spiritual consciousness to the possibilities of our human nature, the possibilities to actually live and work together in caring communities. Now, as that awareness develops, combined with the recognition of the imperative to change, what we're seeing is people mobilizing all around the world, not only in terms of these, you know, truly magnificent peace demonstrations like February 15, 2003, but also the efforts emerging by people to rebuild local community, rebuild their local economies based on local independent businesses, all the citizen and environmental initiatives. What we're seeing is an awakening of citizen leadership from the grassroots, and I think this is the way this change has to take place, is through essentially growing the new institutions and cultures from the bottom up through citizen leadership and initiative.
I'm encouraged by those too, but February 15, 2003, you can read a different way. You can say, look, this is the biggest peace demonstration ever in the history of the world. There were 10, 15 million people simultaneously protesting. There was this awakening from the grassroots, and the people in power said, too bad, we're going to war.
Yeah, but it wasn't a bad first start. I mean, part of what we have to remind ourselves is we're working against 5,000 years of momentum, and that peace demonstration was totally unique. I mean, the fact that you had this happening simultaneously on the same day with no central organization, no operating budget, not even a charismatic leader standing up saying, follow me, but this was self-organized by millions of people acting on shared values and each exercising a leadership role with a common global vision, nothing like that has ever happened before in the whole of the human experience, partly because it couldn't happen before. But we now have that capability, and we have that one demonstration. It's just a start.
You stress the importance of stories, the way we frame things, the way we tell ourselves how we're interpreting the world. Why do you stress that so much?
The stories define our culture. Most adults are operating within the framework of whatever the prevailing cultural context is, or the cultural stories that define our values and the proper relationships between human beings. Now, part of the reality of our current politics is that a small group of folks from the extreme right, working from the interests of a corporate plutocracy combined with a small group of religious theocrats, have essentially gained control of the primary stories that define our culture. And by doing that, they shape the political debate in ways that whatever answers come out of it tend to serve the interests of empire. Now, what I'm saying here is that we need to recognize these stories, and we need to be bringing forward the alternative stories that delegitimate empire and recognize our human capacities to move beyond empire and to live in a more balanced relationship with one another and with the earth.
And part of that is just looking at the presuppositions that people have about human nature, whether we're this Hobbesian creature or whether there are better impulses and sentiments of human beings that are repressed by those who are in charge of the empire.
Exactly.
And explain a little bit why you think there are these more optimistic elements of human nature that have been suppressed.
Yeah. Well, this whole thing that we are, you know, we are inherently greedy, violent creatures, or the religious stories about we're fallen sinners, all of these essentially deny our capacity to live in a cooperative relationships of mutual responsibility. Now, if you actually look at, first of all, if that were actually true, human societies would have collapsed long, long ago. But we also, the thing I've come to recognize, if we look at the understanding that comes from developmental psychology, from the people that really study the development of the human consciousness from our birth to elderhood, if we receive the proper emotional supports from family and community, we move steadily from a more self-centered, narcissistic view of the world, concerned with my interests and my wealth and my power, to gradually moving to a much more enlightened consciousness, where we move through this stage of what I call a socialized or enculturated consciousness, where we recognize we need to live together, we need to live within some set of rules, but we simply accept whatever the culture is, to an awakening of a cultural consciousness and ultimately a spiritual consciousness that gives us a foundation to relate to one another and Earth in a wholly new way.
Well, there's a vision of a new way of looking at our world and the possibilities of changing the world. David Corton, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thanks for your invitation.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.